Early in his 1993 encyclical Veritatis Splendor, John Paul II points to a fundamental contradiction in modern anthropology. On the one hand, the dominant tradition of Western liberal secular thought construes human freedom as a story of progress, whereby the modern individual is gradually unshackled from both external norms and internal constraints, such as the virtues. Prior to the Enlightenment, had substantially restricted religious, political, economic, artistic, and indeed sexual self-expression. So the story goes. On this account, freedom is construed as unfettered self-realization, less a rational appetite, as Aquinas defines the will, than an unconditional right, for which there does no longer appear to exist any corresponding obligation. At the same time, various naturalistic and, in tendency, reductionist explanatory schemes associated with today's hard sciences attempt to trace the uniquely varied, fluid, and interactive manifestations of consciousness to their measurable neural underpinnings. Indeed, by their very nature and tendency, if not intent, such reductionist accounts conflate what stands to be explained, consciousness, with its biochemical foundations. As John Paul writes, side by side with its exaltation of freedom, yet oddly in contrast with it, modern culture radically questions the existence of freedom. Hence, it often appears, quote, as if a dialectic, if not an absolute conflict, between freedom and nature were characteristic of the structure of human history. Whether the efficient causes shaping consciousness are located in our environment, as behaviorism would put it, or whether they are located in our biochemical processes, as neurobiological accounts now assert, does not substantially alter the conclusions to which the reductionist methods point. For in either case, consciousness is not so much explained as it is explained away, seemingly unmasked as a chimera, a mere epiphenomenon of causal forces whose impact science may capture in quantitative terms, ex post facto, to be sure, yet which individual consciousness can never grasp, let alone transcend, in actual experience. Let us provisionally accept John Paul's characterization of modernity's strictly immanent explanatory framework as having, however inadvertently, saddled us with what he calls an absolute conflict between freedom and nature. We appear to be confronted with a particularly virulent instance of the old antinomy between freedom and necessity, between a claim to total self-realization, unconstrained by any norms and obligations, and a wholly deterministic account of nature, asserting explanatory authority over all phenomena, including that of human consciousness. Now, such a conflict, I submit, cannot be solved within a purely immanent frame, because the antinomy in question is itself a product of our having, over the course of centuries, embraced this frame to the point that it now categorically defines what shall count as legitimate knowledge. Knowledge on this view is construed as a product, not a gift. It is essentially construed as impersonal, quantifiable information, valued either as a conduit for further research or for its potential commercial application as a patented commodity. While this understanding of knowledge as the fruit of what Augustine calls curiositas is surely here to stay, having by now utterly transformed our world for several centuries, it is also, to say the very least, alarmingly incomplete. Thus, quantitative information about the biochemical and neurological operations subtending what we call consciousness surely is not the same as actually being conscious, and thus experiencing the astounding fluidity and complexity of which it is comprised, say, finding oneself in the presence of and truly attending to another human being, or the face of a stranger, or someone close and dear, or being transfixed by a bird that happens to soar above. Or the myriad qualities that we associate with remembering, feeling anxiety, experiencing sadness, grief, desire, creative passion, empathy, love, hope, and so on. Add to these a second level awareness whereby our primary intentionality is amplified by the realization that just now I'm experiencing one of these states in entirely distinctive ways, and we begin to see that being conscious encompasses far more than the basic calculative awareness needed for some interested activity to be brought to conclusion. Now this takes us then to a paradox, namely that to construe freedom merely as the absence of constraint ends up denuding the human person of all contact with being, and ultimately reduces consciousness itself to a mere figment of some bygone humanist worldview. Exemplary in this regard is Nietzsche's dismissal of the, quote, unfree will as a mythology. And I quote, in real life, it is only a matter of strong and weak wills, end quote. Here, volition and freedom are construed as interchangeable, with freedom reduced to the projection of sheer force, what Nietzsche calls Kraft, onto the visible world. Like some steroid-infused version of Occam's nominalist God, Nietzsche's individual measures its freedom as the overcoming of all internal constraints, such as the virtues of prudence, temperance, humility, and all external obligations, such as providing others with a rational and intelligible account of how one makes use of freedom. Wholly bereft of reflection and self-awareness, this seemingly free individual has in fact been reduced to a bundle of atavistic and feral impulses. Dispensing with the language of self-examination, discernment, judgment, and responsible choice, Nietzsche credits the strong personality with what he calls a mere instinct for freedom, ein Instinkt zur Freiheit. Curiously, then, existentialism's affirmation of freedom as some quasi-instinctual, unfettered, and unaccountable doing ends up mirroring the so-called explanations of consciousness offered up by modern scientific reductionism. Which takes me to my principal thesis today, namely that human freedom remains unintelligible unless, in laying claim to it, we also acknowledge a dimension of being wholly transcendent to us, what since Plato has been called logos. For all human inquiry into specific phenomena is premised on this a priori intelligibility of the world. The very possibility of knowledge presupposes that intelligible meaning can be discovered within what at first often seems but an inchoate flux of appearances. Such a presupposition is justified by our repeated experience that natural phenomena will disclose to us the intrinsic structure, or, as Hopkins will call it, inscape, provided we learn to respond to them with due patience and without pre-existing designs. Hence, if nature is to become the subject of focused and searching observation, there must first unfold a process of contemplation, that is, a mode of seeing that receives and embraces the world simply as it gives itself, as appearance. Now, to contemplate is to experience an elemental sense of freedom simply because in opening ourselves to the phenomenon as it gives itself, and for the duration of our inhabiting an undesigning contemplative stance, we are freed from the thraldom of selfhood, desire, and interest. Well before the advent of Christianity, contemplation, theoria, was understood to be the apex of human flourishing. It is so for Plato, think of the Phaedrus or the Timaeus, and Aristotle, Book 10 of the Ethics. Yet it is principally through its Neoplatonist inflection in the writings of Plotinus, Porphyry, and Proclus that early Christianity came to view contemplation not merely as a philosophical concept, but to embrace it as a spiritual and quasi-liturgical practice. Thus, for Plotinus, the subject of contemplation is ordered towards self-transcendence, toward a state of sheer receptivity and humility. Altogether central to the ethical formation of the human being, contemplation for Plotinus is preeminently realized in our encounter with beauty. In the beauty of visible, natural forms, quote, the greatest, the ultimate contest is set before our souls. All our toil and trouble is for this, not to be left without a share of in the best of visions. The man who attains this is blessed in seeing that blessed sight, and he who fails at it has failed utterly. Hence, Plotinus is careful to distinguish between merely hedonistic gazing and a kind of contemplative seeing, where the act of seeing fully coincides with the ethos by which it ought to be governed. What transpires is, in Plotinus' phrase, a contemplation of the world of forms, wherein we may experience the pure fact of form in its full and incontrovertible givenness. Whereas perceptual consciousness, ordinary of garden variety, daily perception, remains forever split into two, as he puts it, and occupied by calculations and projects, believing that nothing can be found until it has been searched for, contemplation opens up a domain of experience free of any such divisions. It entails our, quote, total absorption in the perception of being as noema, so fully surrendered to that the beholder forgets himself in what is beheld. This is from Hans Urs von Balthasar. Indeed, the true goal of contemplation is precisely for the seer to become the seen. Or, as Nicholas of Cusa will put it later, in contemplation, seeing and being seen coincide. Videre et videri coincidunt. In so liberating the human being from the thraldom of desire, dominion, and the bondage of subjectivity, contemplation enables the finite soul to understand itself as a medium for nature at rest in contemplation of the vision of itself. That is Plotinus' phrase. Inasmuch as contemplation and vision have no limits, they free the human being from the shifting determinacy of discursive reason and instead open up on a condition of total silence. In time, Aquinas echoes that implication when remarking how the moral virtues, inasmuch as they counteract the passions, belong, quote, dispositively to the contemplative life. Yet even as, quote, the contemplation of truth amounts to a single act, Aquinas insists that it cannot unfold as an unmediated vision. Rather, he notes by way of quoting Romans 1:20, in the present state of life, human contemplation is impossible without phantasms. What distinguishes such spiritual sight, then, is not freedom from all visible appearance, but instead a capacity for grasping the invisible God both in and by means of sensory presentation. Hence, Aquinas notes, intellectual knowledge does not consist in the phantasms themselves, but in our contemplating in them the purity of the intelligible truth. Contemplation opens up an experience of freedom no longer constrained by interest and the Augustinian lust for dominion, libido dominandi, which limit the beholder to seeing merely what was desired beforehand. Where the idolatrous gaze would take possession of its visible object, contemplative vision frees eye and mind to the point that the visible phenomenon is received as a manifestation of the logos, to which it owes both its very existence and its specific intelligible form. Having thus far sketched my argument in somewhat abstract language, let me offer two specific examples by way of illustration. The first one I take from Nicholas of Cusa's 1453 treatise on mystical theology, De Visione Dei. What is arguably his most popular work finds Nicholas joining a protracted, often acrimonious debate concerning the nature of mystical contemplation. At its heart is the question of whether mystical vision constitutes a strictly affective response and experience, or whether, alternatively, it involves, quote, a somewhat intellectual movement, as Aquinas had put it. Responding to a request for clarification on the nature of mystical vision that had been sent to him by the Benedictine monks at Tegernsee Abbey, Nicholas opens his treatise with an instruction on how to look at a Christ icon that, wrought to his specifications, he had included along with the manuscript of his new book. While the specific icons referenced by Nicholas have all been lost by now, he provides a rather accurate description of it. The icon shows a face, almost certainly meant to be Christ's, that will lock onto the beholder's gaze regardless of the latter's spatial location. The formal composition of the icon somewhat recalls the presentation of the Christ icon already found on Byzantine coins, manufactured under Justinian II in 691-692. And that, in turn, that portrait bears a close resemblance to the famous mid-6th century Pantocrator icon at the St. Catherine's Monastery in Sinai. That's only a detail, by the way, of the entire picture. More particularly, Nicholas's reference to the, quote, Veronica Chapel at Koblenz, close to his native Bernkastel, taps into the popular legend of Christ's face imprinted on the cloth handed to him by Veronica at the sixth station of the cross, a legend that took hold in Western Christianity starting in the 12th century as part of a surging popular fascination with Christ's passion. Corresponding to the Eastern Church's much older legendary Edessa Mandylion, also lost, though allegedly preserved in a number of replicas, the Vera icon derives its authority from popular belief that the image in question was not wrought by human hands, and hence is called in Greek an archaeopoieton. Capitalizing on the anagrammatic relation between this unique image, Vera icon, and its human recipient, Veronica, Nicholas emphasizes that the contemplative gaze here confronts no artificial sign, but an unmediated presence, no product, but a gift, donum, Christ handing over his imago, much like he passed the bread and the chalice at the Last Supper on the preceding night. Right away, Nicholas insists that the Christ icon is not a painting, but a presence, a face made manifest, rather than an artificial representation. The icon, that is, does not present the beholder with a commentary-dependent artifact, but instead summons her to overcome her singular, contracted point of view. Nicholas here echoes arguments advanced by Nikephoros and Theodore the Studite in the early 9th century to the effect that far from circumscribing Christ's divine nature, the icon depicts the face of Jesus, the prosopon, the person of the Word. In the icon we see neither a divine nor a human nature, but rather the face of the person of Jesus, who is both God and man. And that is, by the way, how Christoph Schönborn puts it in the book on the Christ icon. It is this focus on the face, and thus on Christ's presence as a person, that accounts for the depth and the force of Nicholas' subsequent argument. For the face is not experienced as merely portrayed, but as always looking at the beholder. We have reason, then, to construe the title of Nicholas' work, De Visione Dei, mainly as a genitivus subjectivus, for the central focus of God's is God's vision of us, not ours of God. Far from a naturalistic and unilateral dominion over what is empirically visible, seeing, for Nicholas, presupposes being seen by God, whose eternal absolute sight, as he calls it, is embodied by the icon. And the icon's gaze is always already upon the beholder before the latter can make it the focus of her sight. To be present to the infinity that is the face of the other, as Immanuel Levinas was to put it famously in the 20th century, is to be created by God's absolute vision, visio absoluta, and it is this being seen that the icon mediates for the finite human being. So for the benefit of the Tegernsee brethren, Nicholas thus encloses a panel, tabellum, containing the figure of an omnivorient individual. I call it, he says, the icon of God. Figuram cuncta videntis tenentem quam iconam Dei appello. As he continues, hang this icon somewhere that is on the north wall, and your brothers stand around it at a short distance from it and observe it. Regardless of the place from which each of you looks at it, each will have the impression that he alone is being looked at by it. To the brother who is situated in the east, it will seem that the face is looking toward the east. To the brother in the south, that the face is looking south. First of all, then, marvel at how it is possible that the face behold each and every one of you at once. For the imagination of the brother who is standing in the east does not at all apprehend the icon's gaze that is being directed to a different region. End quote. Finding the icon's gaze moved immovably as he changes his position, a monk may, as Nicholas puts it, therefore ask the approaching brother whether the icon's gaze moves continually with him. And being told that the icon's gaze moves both with him and in the opposite manner, quote, he will believe his fellow monk. The icon then has a paradoxical effect of giving rise to a spiritual community, even as it instills in each of its members a sense of being the sole and abiding focus of its gaze. As if the icon saw only this person and nothing else. Not only does the icon's omnivorient gaze metaphorically instantiate God's absolute vision, but it also enjoins each individual viewer to recognize the strictly partial and incomplete deliverances of his gaze. It shows me that I'm not in control of the space of my visual perceptions. As soon as I listen to someone who is looking at a shared focus of attention from a different viewpoint, I start to appreciate that something is invisible to me. Nicholas's instructions to the monks frame the icon within the relatively new genre of the imago pietatis, a type of image designed to induce in the beholder a state of focused and sustained spiritual self-examination. You can go to the next picture. This new genre of the devotional image thus mediates between the didactic function of earlier religious imagery, which depicts scenes from biblical narrative, and the hieratic images of Christ and the saints. Perhaps the version closest to the panel that Nicholas had conveyed along with his manuscript is the Christ icon painted by Van Eyck around 1438, of which is still extant in three copies. And this is one of those three copies, quite possibly the one that he would have seen in Brussels during his stay there in 1452. Byzantine icon theory would insist that the image in question is not to be considered a portrait. It does not represent Christ, but asks the beholder to meet him, to achieve a mental and spiritual vision of Christ by exclusively responding to the gaze of the icon. Thus, there are no narrative elements, no background scenery, no symbolic objects of the kind beginning to enter early 15th century religious and portrait painting. Instead, the icon constitutes an absolute presence and a generality of presence outside any context, a timeless and unlocated face. Rather than drawing on the gestural rhetoric found in early 15th century religious painting, the icon proceeds experimentally, experimentaliter, as Nicholas puts it, by eschewing any association with pictorial illusionism. Hence, Nicholas' exegesis is not focused on the image per se, but on the gaze it instills in the beholder, a gaze whose spiritual import will only be realized insofar as it detaches itself from what is empirically visible. For the true locus of visio is a function of how rather than what. That is, concerns not the object seen, but the spiritual self-awareness that the gaze induces in the beholder. As Nicholas points out, quote, it is not the essence of sight that sight beholds one object more than another. Rather, the perfection of sight stems from its capacity to behold each and everything at once. This Nicholas calls absolute sight, which, as he says, excels all the acuity, swiftness, and power of actual sight, insofar as it has been freed from all eyes and organs. Absolve ab omnibus oculis et organis. The icon then furnishes the heuristic device by means of which Nicholas proposes to clarify his understanding of mystical theology as a form of spiritual sight. No longer tethered to a particular object or referent, but instead reflexively doubling back on itself, mental vision gradually suspends empirical sight and its underlying naturalistic conception of meaning. Instead, by interacting with the icon, or rather with the gaze that the icon models for us, the Benedictines at Tegernsee are to be led, quote, into that most sacred darkness. Such a leading by the hand, a manuductio, a catechesis in how properly to see, positions De Visione Dei on the border between practical and speculative theology. We can go to the next image. Let us now consider one more reading of an icon, one that bears a striking resemblance to Nicholas' account of how mystic contemplation frees the beholder from the constraints of finite, self-enclosed existence. Perhaps no poem of Gerard Manley Hopkins more vividly captures natural being as the mediation of the incarnate logos in visible form than his 1877 sonnet, The Windhover. Considered by Hopkins to be the best thing I ever wrote, as he puts it, and among the most widely anthologized poems in the English language, the sonnet's power stems from the way that its highly particularized and ecstatic visuality, as well as its luxuriant soundscape, are presented as essential to a knowledge of Christ, albeit in no way identical with him. Thus, the kestrel is first and foremost a contingent natural being. Moreover, given its spatio-temporal determinacy as this bird, seen at St. Beunus on May 30th, 1877, executing distinctive patterns of flight and motion, it also has an essential quality. It is this fusion of the contingent and the essential that prompts Hopkins to view the kestrel as both figuring the divine source in which all being originated and as what he calls the terminus of God's providence to which it seeks to return. The motional trope of hovering thereby aptly situates this bird and this beholder in a communion of sorts, at once inhabiting a physical place and a spiritual state, suspended between heaven and earth. So I'll quickly read this poem. I caught this morning, morning's minion, kingdom of daylight's dauphin, dapple dawn-drawn falcon, in his riding over the rolling level underneath him steady air, and striding high there, how he rung upon the rein of a wimpling wing in his ecstasy. Then off forth on swing, as a skate's heel sweeps smooth on a bow bend. The hurl and gliding rebuffed the big wind. My heart in hiding stirred for a bird, the achieve of, the mastery of the thing. Brute beauty and valor and act. Oh, air, pride, plume here, buckle. And the fire that breaks from thee, then, a billion times told, lovelier, more dangerous, O my chevalier. No wonder of it, sheer plod makes plough down sillion shine, and blue bleak embers are, my dear, fall gall themselves and gash gold vermilion. What dominates is the sense of a beginning, a dawn revelation with morning conspicuously doubled in the opening line, that features the kestrel's temporal being in his ecstasy, yielding to the kingdom for which the bird itself is the figure. Thus, Daylight's Dauphin typologically links the kestrel to the figure of Christ, to whom the sonnet, uniquely in this regard among Hopkins's poems, is dedicated. The Windhover's being is consummated by this mediation. It does not belong to the order of objects, but instead is pure act, a distinctive pattern of movements fused into a single gestalt by the poem's end-rhymed riding, striding, and gliding. Movement is one of the ways in which, as Maximus the Confessor had argued long before, an essence will disclose itself, insofar as the movement in question exhibits a distinctive pattern. And I quote from Maximus's Ambigua, "All things move either in a linear, circular, or spiral manner. All motion, in other words, unfolds in simple and composite patterns. At once effortless, yet teeming with energy, utterly controlled, yet free, the kestrel's dynamic manifestation transfixes the beholder with its very achieve and supernatural brute beauty." Ultimately, the kestrel's sheer mastery of the thing that is most fully being what it was created to be embodies Christ's perfection. And yet, compared with the splendor of the kestrel's morning daylight, Christ's is a fire a billion times told lovelier, more dangerous. "Hier sein ist herrlich, being here is glorious," Rilke will write in his seventh Duino elegy, with far greater metaphysical confidence yet. Hopkins's sonnet conveys such glory, albeit not in the form of a proposition asserted, but as the event of sheer being witnessed in all its beauty and valor and act. Hence, the poet's heart in hiding seeks not simply to participate in, but to merge with the Christ icon that is so visibly figured by the kestrel in flight, emerging rendered audible by the internal rhyme of the octet's final line, "My heart stirred for a bird." To see and to know is also to love, to steer for that which is seen. Contemplative seeing for Hopkins, no less than for Nicholas of Cusa, involves recognizing oneself as the addressee of the phenomenal world, and to find oneself moved by this encounter. As Maximus puts it, quote, "From God come both our general power of motion, for he is our beginning, and the particular way that we move toward him, for he is our end." To see, then, is to be summoned by that which gives itself to be seen, to be moved intellectively, as Maximus puts it, and to become a knowing intellect. But if it knows, it surely loves that which it knows, and if it loves, it certainly suffers an ecstasy toward it as an object of love. That's also from Ambigua 7. As Hopkins had put it in a notebook entry, "What you look hard at seems to look hard at you." The kestrel's ecstasy transfers onto the beholder, whose spiritual sense, thus, is set free by means of the visible phenomenon to participate in that which remains beyond all vision. In Maximus' phrase, the beholder has sanctified his sense with uncontaminated images. Characteristic of many of Hopkins' nature sonnets, the Windhover mobilizes the formal division of the Petrarchan sonnet into octet and sestet in order to move from a particular image to what transcends the visible image altogether. In this case, the pivot is located in the enigmatic word buckle of line 10. It marks the turning point where the visible is effectively supplanted by the knowledge that it can only ever be a figura, typos, for, but can never actually coincide with, that toward which it points. A great deal of philological detective work has been lavished on the meaning of buckle. Of the many connotations variously imputed to the word, two in particular carry theological significance. First, buckle as a turn, loop, or bell-like curve, a swerve, indicating that an apex has been reached and is now followed by a downward motion. And secondly, buckle as the link between two distinct, though not opposed, domains. In this instance, those of finite appearance and transcendent truth, respectively. At the same time, Hopkins' unusual choice of capitalizing the conjunction buckle and emphasizes that these two domains of being are distinct, yet coordinated, dissimilar, but not unrelated. Thus, the image of the kestrel points to, but nowise merges with, the transcendent and ineffable God, the fire that breaks from thee then a billion times told, lovelier, more dangerous. The relationship between inscape, natural being, and Christ our Lord is thus one of analogy. We are not presented with an origanist scenario in which the visible competes with, or rather against, the invisible for the same epistemological space. Nor, for that matter, does Hopkins' sonnet construe the visible image as some strictly provisional scaffolding, soon to be consummated by its ineffable divine referent. Instead, as the poem's dedication makes clear, the kestrel's Christocentric significance is honored precisely by keeping both dimensions in productive tension and balance. In so doing, the poem avoids an outright collapsing of immanence into transcendence, and vice versa. Instead, it presents visible being in tensioned relation, in a tensioned relation to its transcendent source. As Hopkins will later put it in his commentary on Ignatius, his presence, God's presence, is a reality though invisible, and though God gives us his word and image, the word and image has with it the divine substance. Correlating inscaped being with the ineffable triune God, and thus fusing octet and sestet into a statement of superior poetic and theological coherence, is this underlying framework of the analogia entis. As Maximus had already written, the God who, quote, has wisely inscribed the marvelous physical phenomena that we see and is ineffably inscribed within them, is rendered legible when he is read by us, communicating to us solely the concept that he exists and not what he is, allowing himself to be seen by analogy through visible things as their creator. Depending on whether this carefully wrought model of analogy is kept in view or not, the intentionality underlying our engagement with the visible world will typically be of one of two kinds. Either an idolatrous gaze will reify a given phenomenon into an anthropomorphic perception, which in turn human desire then seeks to appropriate as an object. The alternative consists of an attentive and undesigning gaze that apprehends the natural phenomenon as an image, icon, capable of mediating in strictly analogical form the logos that is at once its source and its end. On this latter understanding, the icon instantiates what Maximus already outlines as the analogy of being. Quote, all things are related to him without being confused with him, who is the essential and personally distinct logos of God the Father. Maximus affirms, with Dionysius, that created or circumscribed beings, or logoi, are never convertible with the logos of divine being itself. Quote, it is not possible for the infinite and the finite to exist simultaneously on the same level of being. Likewise, writing some 1100 years later, Hopkins also considers logos and logoi to be analogically related. Created being never merely is. Rather, in its conspicuously dynamic manifestation, It solicits the human beholder's participation, instantiating a pattern of call and response that Hopkins calls bidding. The dynamic inscape pattern of the wind hover's movements not only affirms its determinate existence, but also constitutes it as a palpable presence. And as such, the bird does indeed liberate the beholder to see in it not only a contingent natural being, but the imago of its transcendent source. It is this analogical dimension of the visible phenomenon that Eric Shivara has in mind when remarking, quote, how creaturely potentiality does not of itself place limits on God, but rather receives its limits from God. Though he does not cast the matter expressly in terms of analogy, Hopkins nevertheless holds the same view. Thus, without denying that there is a universal, really, and not only logically, he points out that ultimately both the species and individual in the brutes, though distinct from one another, must neither be confused with nor dissociated from the Logos, whom they manifest. Where Maximus had distinguished sharply between one divine Logos, or word, and multiple Logoi, individual things having their own organization and purpose, Hopkins also affirms that, quote, God is so deeply present to everything that it would be impossible for him, except for his infinity, not to be identified with them. Conversely, were it not for God's infinity, he could not be so intimately present to things. This is also from his Ignatius commentary. Created being can only ever be, but never can never be less than, a figure or image of God. Thus we recall, the Fourth Lateran Council had affirmed when stipulating an infinitely greater dissimilarity that at all times circumscribes the analogy between finite and transcendent being. Very briefly then, let me conclude with this reflection. Their starkly different idioms and backgrounds notwithstanding, both Kusa and Hopkins understand the freedom of contemplative vision to consist in this. First, that it frames visible being not as sheer otherness, an object indifferently awaiting our perception, acquisition, and consumption, but as the dynamic manifestation of the Logos, to which both the visible phenomenon and its beholder owe their existence. Second, that our visual outlook on the world should not be misconstrued as a taking possession of it, but instead as an act of witnessing and attesting to the reality of what is seen. Third, that in contemplation we engage the visible world as ethically responsible beholders. It is a responsibility that we cannot meet unless we are properly free to assume it, namely, by suspending the myriad interests, designs, and desires that would have us prepossess, fetishize, and idolize the phenomenon, and thereby fail to see it. Fourth, that contemplative freedom, understood as an ethical responsibility, pivots on our responsiveness to the visible phenomenon, taking it not as a contingent object of perception, but as a manifestation, a visible figure of the invisible source to which it owes its existence and its unique determinacy. And finally, fifth, that to behold means to face, in the sense of facing, confronting, to be seen and to be judged by the Christ icon that is visible being. For in its very manifestation, as Hopkins puts it elsewhere, each mortal thing does one thing and the same, crying, "What I do is me, for that I came." Hence, in contemplating fully and freely the unfathomable gift of visible being, the beholder at last, quote, acts in God's eye what in God's eye he is, Christ. Thank you very much. Yes.
Well, thank you for this beautiful presentation. I'm wondering, especially in your conclusion, your second point, regarding that the vision is not a possession of the object. So I take it to be that your account of vision is more of an interaction, a dynamic a dynamic interaction between the two. I wonder whether that comes into conflict with the Thomist idea of the beatific vision as reception of the divine essence, and importantly, the questions which Thomas's view on this issue solves. For example, Thomas sees that the ultimate end, the supernatural ultimate end, perfect happiness for human being, is the beatific vision, because the divine essence encompasses all created good. Or you may ask the question of, okay, I may accept that the divine essence encompasses all the creative good, but how does that entail that my vision of the divine essence also gives me all the good I may want? Well, the answer is that because in that vision you're taking in the essence, it's not just an activity of seeing and interacting, in which case you can question why does that interaction provide all the good I need? But if it is a reception of the essence, then there's no more question to ask. I'm just wondering if this is meant to just be a different aspect of the same picture, or...
That's a great question, and I think in a way it allows me now to sort of clarify why, specifically in the context of the Hopkins Summit, I was so insistent on the analogia dimension. So that the kind of seeing that Hopkins describes in his great sonnets of the mid-1870s and in his notebooks apprehends in each instance the particular thing seen as what is sort of in patristic writing called figura, right? I mean, typos. It is nothing less than a prefiguration of the visio beatifica, but it can by its very nature never fully be coincident with it. So that, I think, is in that sense, I see the beatific vision is the telos, of which in our empirical dealings with phenomena, if we deal with them appropriately, we get temporary intimations. So they are not in competition with one another, which is why, again, I also stress that, you know, the challenge of reading not just Hopkins or Fuse, but of thinking of the way that a great deal of modern poetry deals with visible experience, visual experience, is that there is so often, except for some truly extraordinary writers, there's so often the point where the writer will yield to the temptation either of collapsing all immanence into transcendence or vice versa. Listen, the trick is to acknowledge that they remain in a kind of productive tension for the time being.
Thank you for that excellent presentation. In this act that is called contemplation, especially the way you summarize it at the end, it seems like we have a special kind of cognitive act where something is given, or a person who's properly disposed can receive something as given. There's a manifestation or a disclosure, and it's in one order, it's in the imminent order of things, but it signifies or points to or symbolizes something in a higher order. Call the transcendent order. In your view, does natural reason, the light of natural reason, suffice to make the move from the immanent order to the transcendent one and read the symbolism? Or is an additional light, a special illumination of a supernatural kind, necessary for that?
The answer would be the second. Because I think an absolutely central ingredient, certainly the way that Hopkins' work, for instance, shows that, but in many cases, I would say, is that in order to see the phenomenon to understand it as something that in a way calls out to us. So it is, it's givenness, rather than a sort of inert three-dimensional being out there, but it's givenness, it's an event. It is not simply a brute sort of natural fact. So to understand, say, a work, a poem, a work of art, a musical work, as a summons, is to understand that we are in a way also being, at least implicitly, we are being judged as to how responsive can we be to what is given to us. So it is never just a matter of natural reason, sort of as it were in truly analytic terms, making the argument, but it must also be experienced, phenomenologically speaking, as a sort of a moment of revelation. Which is why Hopkins, as some very good writers on critics on Hopkins have pointed out, in a way for his nature poetry in particular, every particular visual experience stages, in a way, the event of the incarnation. So it is always.
Okay, just as a follow-up then, if the pagan philosopher, like Plotinus,
yes,
engaged in this contemplation as you described it, it would then follow that they received supernatural illumination.
And I think even though Proclus might have defended his teacher against that suggestion, I think there is plenty in Plotinus' actual writings to suggest that. Yes.
A number of the fathers thought that pagan philosophers had received supernatural light.
Right. And in the case of Plotinus in particular, I mean, having sort of over the past year warmed my way to the Aeneas again, I think that is an argument I would be very sympathetic to.
Just a couple of comments quickly. I think that it's very hard to articulate the experience that transcends ordinary experience. I think you're kind of courageous to bring that forward with us publicly. One of the other attempts to do that that I've experienced is Martin Buber's I Am Now.
Mm-hmm.
And the translation by Kaufman is good. The translation by Smith is horrific. And the second thing is, as I was listening to some of the debate after you gave your talk, I was thinking about Moses and the burning bush as another theophany.
Yes.
But it had a, it wasn't, I'm not sure how to say this, there wasn't a history of theophanies where Moses could say, ah, of course, God, I know who that is, in a burning bush, so it must be, it was like flesh. But to me that kind of over, and then when he spoke, which is very much like you and I are speaking, he was answering. But the answer was enigmatic. I am that am. So I just think that like what you're working on is a kind of transcendent but possible experience that is not just met in Cusa and Hopkins, but is met in scripture and in other places.
Well, I mean, it's not a question, but there are some things I would like to say in response to it. First is, I suppose it is courageous to try and put into words what I see unfolding here. Courageous probably in the sense that most of it will end in failure, but that's okay. It's still, it's a wonderful challenge at which to fail. What you remark about Buber is absolutely right, and I think that, you know, for instance, Jean-Louis Chrétien in his The Call and the Response, which is a book about these phenomena, so uses also the sort of I-Thou relationship as a template for phenomenology more broadly. It's interesting that Buber's Ich und Du actually was preceded by Coleridge, who in his Opus Maximum, in his last one of his many notoriously unfinished works, talks about this I-Thou relationship in exactly those terms around 1830. And it turns out, in, yet more, that his most important advisor was an eminent Jewish intellectual in London, Hyman Hurwitz. with whom he was in conversation. And in that Opus Maximum, there is a moment in which Coleridge, clearly drawn also on biographical experiences, essentially describes how when the infant sees the face of the mother, it sees the face not as merely an assemblage of discrete parts, but immediately as a face. So that, and then he says, and how often in at night when I remembered those kinds of experiences, I would call out to my mother saying, touch me so that I may be there. So it is not, the touch here is not that of the mother in order to ascertain her reality, but he asks for her to touch him so that he feels that he's real. And so this is sort of an extreme version of the way in which the phenomenon, in disclosing itself to us, actually also deepens our sense of being here. And I think that is one of the things that we tend to gravely underplay in modern, in the landscape of modern critical thinking, in which we tend to think of ourselves almost, perhaps as a professional hazard, as self-contained arbiters of what counts as real. But we presuppose a tremendous amount, or perhaps better said, we ignore a great deal about the extent to which our intellectual and emotive and affective and spiritual formation is actually contingent on this kind of way in which we feel certain things viscerally calling out to us.
That sounds like what you mentioned just in passing about Levinas.
Yes.